Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 16th of October. Our guest this hour talks about the years 1961 to 1969, a time of collective optimism, or at least some of it was optimistic, full of energy and determination on the part of many World War II veterans. And our guest this hour was right in the middle of all of the 1960s in so many ways. We're so happy to have with us this hour Nicholas Katzenbach. He has written his memoir, Some of It Was Fun, Working with RFK and LBJ. He was Deputy Attorney General in the Kennedy administration and then Attorney General and Undersecretary of State for Lyndon Johnson. And he then served as Senior Vice President and General Counsel for IBM. It's really an amazing book because so much was happening, his involvement in the Civil Rights Movement and registering a student at the University of Mississippi and confrontations with J. Edgar Hoover and with George Wallace and the assassinations we lived through in the 1960s and where he was at the time and his relationship with Bobby Kennedy. And it's just it's a great read for those who are interested in that time of American history. And we'll be welcoming phone calls from Mr. Katzenbach. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in the internet, on the internet, that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org for you to join our conversation. Nicholas Katzenbach, hello. Thank you so much for being with us. I really enjoyed your book.
Thank you. It's a pleasure, Kathleen.
Yeah, I'm glad that you read it. Can you start with the beginning here and remind us of the optimism that you had? You were in, I believe, Germany on a special Ford Foundation grant, and all that was happening in the United States with John Kennedy running for president and winning, and you really wanted to be a part of that. The optimism you had that you say was a part of so much of the spirit of World War II veterans. You wanted to be there.
Yes, I think that World War II probably had a lot to do with it. A lot of my friends were working for Kennedy, and there I was in Europe, not on a Ford Foundation Fellowship, and I just wanted very much to be part of the action. And when I say it was interesting because Jack Kennedy had been a junior officer in World War II. I had been a junior officer in World War II, and that was true of many of us. And I think we felt that the country was in need of leadership and that we were arrogant enough to think that we could do it and we could make a difference.
And you talk early in the book about hoping that young people now will have the same passion for government that you had many years ago. Do they, or have they become quite cynical over the years?
Well, I'm hopeful right now that they're not as cynical as they have been. It seems to me they've been cynical. People have distrusted politicians for good reason. I mean, after all, being in politics, being in government, is meant to be public service. That's serving the public. And in my view, it's the most wonderful thing you can do if you can succeed in helping this country to be what it has been, what I hope it is, and what it can be.
So you got a phone call. Tell the story because I think it's great fun. You were in Geneva, wasn't it? You were in Geneva, yeah, that's right. And you have a phone call from somebody who said, if you want a job in this administration, Mr. Katzenbach, you better get over to Washington right now, and so you did.
That's right. I took a plane the next morning.
How did you get in the administration? Who did you talk to?
I talked to quite a few people, but I guess the principal one that I talked to, because it's how I got the job, was Byron White. He had been at law school with me, and we had taken some classes together, and I guess we had gotten married on almost the same day. He got married on a Sunday, and I got married on a Saturday. And so he asked me whether I'd like to be in the Justice Department, and some of my friends were there and had agreed to take jobs there, and I said yes, and so he set up an appointment with Bobby Kennedy, and I ended up in the Justice Department.
Mm-hmm. And talk a bit about I remember this and have read about it a lot, but the perception people had of Bobby Kennedy and your perception of Bobby Kennedy, he seems, from your description in the book, to be an attorney general who was incredibly accessible, who would drop in on people's offices, who really respected the views of the people who were working for him, very egalitarian in a way.
He was absolutely that. You know, when he was very reluctant to take the job, and I think his father was pressing the president to give it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack Kennedy did. And Bobby was very conscious of his being too young, and perhaps people would think of him as being very political since he'd managed a campaign for his brother. And so he staffed the Justice Department largely with people that had a reputation for academic legal excellence, who were not, most of them had not been very active in the campaign. And it was clear that he wanted to run the Department of Justice in a way that it wouldn't get in any trouble, and it would be doing what the president wanted, and it would be following the law.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very high on the rule of law and the necessity of government paying very close scrutiny to law and doing it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And he was informal. I mean, it was wonderful. He used to go around, drop in on people's offices and say, "What are you doing?" and tell me about it. And that had never happened before. and he got the department, the civil servants who were there, who were permanently there, grew to love him. They shared in his prestige, his closeness to the president, and that you could feel the lift of spirit in the department from having that man as attorney general.
Mm-hmm. And he continued to have this good heart. You jump ahead for a moment to one of the great tragedies of the 1960s, a huge tragedy for the country when he lost his soul after his brother died for quite some time, but still would have these big Christmas parties. I was moved by that you would go to. You were invited to those every year, even after his brother died.
Yes, and they were wonderful parties. I remember the first one of the children's parties. We bussed them in, and the lawyers were dressed as clowns, and we had horse rides for the kids, and we had entertainers who happened to be in Washington, who donated their services. It was the first time that I had ever heard and met Bill Cosby. And he had those children rolling on the floor in laughter. He was wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Was Bobby Kennedy's first passion when you were with him to take on Jimmy Hoffa and organized crime?
Well, I didn't know anything about organized crime, and I don't think Mr. Hoover knew very much. And I was concerned in a way about the Hoffa thing. There was an awful lot of publicity about a vendetta against Hoffa and Bobby Kennedy's being ruthless in his attack on Hoffa and so forth. And so I got interested in finding out more about it. And Bobby had an open door policy, and we could go to any meetings on anything and we wanted to. So I went to his meetings on organized crime and his meetings on Hoffa. And I became absolutely convinced, as he had been, that organized crime was a serious matter and something that we had to do something about, and that Jimmy Hoffa was an evil person who had gotten himself mixed up with organized crime and mixed up with crooked politicians, and that it was worth the effort to go after the head of a very, very powerful union who was stealing from the union, robbing the union, and using that power for bad purposes.
Mm-hmm. And what about the beginnings of interest in civil rights? When did you, and did it come up when you first interviewed for the job here, when did you know how important this was going to be to American history, to the whole decade of the 60s, to the Kennedy administration and later the Johnson administration?
Well, you know, it's very hard to say. We knew that civil rights was going to be important because civil rights had been important in the election, and it may well have been may as well have been Kennedy's action, and both Kennedy's action, helping getting Dr. King out of jail, which might have turned the vote in Illinois that decided the election. But the problem was what you could do about it. And what Bobby wanted to do about it, he hired 200 lawyers for the Civil Rights Division, and he put Burke Marshall in charge of it, very able man. And but that was a question of bringing lawsuits, mostly voting rights cases, which he thought were important. But you bring a case in the state courts and voting rights, you'd help the Legal Defense Fund with their cases and voting rights. But it would be 5 years before you ever got it resolved.
Mm-hmm.
And there they were marching in the streets, being beaten, fire hoses, all cattle prods, all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm.
We had the Freedom Riders trying to ride a bus through the integrated bus through the South. All of these were constitutional rights that the African Americans were entitled to, and they were being deprived of them, and they were entitled to protection of those rights. It was our responsibility to try to protect them, and we had no means to protect them other than sending troops in.
Tell me about, you called them, I believe, the three bravest men you've ever known, starting with James Meredith. We forget about these times in American history, well, don't they? These were courageous people.
Oh, they were incredibly. Of course, that was true of many of the civil rights people, and even the children.
Yes,
who were courageous, who the police would. Turn hoses on and so forth when 10-year-olds demonstrate. But Jim Meredith thought he was entitled to go to college at the University of Mississippi, as he was. And the courts agreed with him, the federal courts agreed with him, and said he had to be admitted. And Governor Barnett was unwilling to admit him to the state university. So there he was. And he was in danger all of the time. He was shot once, but he stuck it out, and he went through. We got him in there. Must be the most expensive education any man ever had, because the Army had to get the Army to quell the riot at Ole Miss, and then he was admitted, and we had troops and marshals protect him the whole 4 years he was there. And you know, he would every now and then say, I don't want all this protection. I'm entitled to be here. I'm a citizen of Mississippi, and I'm entitled to have the same rights as anybody else. I want you people out. And he wouldn't have lasted, you know, an hour if we'd taken them out.
Right.
But we talked him out of it each time. And one of the happy endings to that is his son, a few years ago, got a PhD from Ole Miss, and is now teaching there.
Isn't that something? And you must have been thinking about all of this, watching the presidential debate at the university, right? It must have been so striking to you.
And, you know, I thought, and I still think how pleased Bobby would have been with something like that, which he never unhappily lived to see.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about, and this is a hard thing to talk about even now, so many years later, but the assassinations of this time period. You talk about, obviously, the president's assassination, Bobby Kennedy's assassination, and this great morale that you had in the Justice Department, all these great causes that everybody was working for, and then your leadership gets assassinated. Martin Luther King, Medgar Evers. What a time that was. What a hard time.
It was a time of violence and hatred, you know.
Yes.
From some, I think only a few, but enough. I mean, the riot at Ole Miss was no fun.
Mm-hmm.
That was not part of the, some of it was fun. But the John Doerr is another person who was a hero. He used to try cases in the South. He wouldn't have any protection. and won them. Mm-hmm. And in a very funny way, he had the respect of all the lawyers that were trying cases against him, even if they were racist and disliked and bitterly what he was doing. He had the respect, and he had the respect of the court. Another very, very brave man.
Mm-hmm.
But there was no answer to the civil rights unless the Congress could be persuaded to act. And that was what frustrated us, because it was very hard to see how you could get Congress to pass really effective civil rights legislation. But finally, Jack Kennedy bit the bullet and took the chance that he could do it after Alabama, after the Vivian Malone and James Hood were admitted to Alabama. And we worked very, very hard to get that passed. And, of course, President Kennedy was assassinated in the middle of it. President Johnson picked up that ball and carried it, and we got very effective legislation. Without that, I think, I don't know what would have happened in this country.
What do you think would have happened?
Well, I suppose somehow or other, either there would have been another civil war, or there would have been many more people killed. Eventually, perhaps, as happened, enough people with sense realized that racial discrimination had been the problem, big problem in this country from the very, very beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so wrong to think that the work we did on behalf of civil rights was work that was being done on behalf of African Americans, because in a very real sense it wasn't. It's a problem of everybody, and it's a problem from which everybody can gain when you can get rid of discrimination on the grounds of race or color or religion. Everybody wins.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Our guest this hour is Nicholas Katzenbach. He is the author of his memoir, Some of It Was Fun, working with RFK and LBJ, and we can include a lot of other names because he was so much a part of the Kennedy and Johnson administrations before becoming senior vice president and general counsel for IBM. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you'd like to send an email, you can do that as well. The email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nicholas Katzenbach is our guest. His memoir just published. Some of it was fun working with RFK and LBJ. Our phone number, 800-486-8655. And Randy is our first caller. Hi, Randy.
Hi, Mr. Katzenbach. First of all, thank you for your service to our country, both uniform and by working with the Kennedys. I had the great privilege of growing up in a farm family with World War II veterans, and was about 8 years old when John Kennedy was elected, and I remember the day well. They all were standing around the bed of a pickup truck, and grandparents, uncles, parents, just feeling like the world now would begin anew with Kennedy's election. Grew up in southern Illinois, in the Paul Simon area, and there was a great reserve down there of what I call these Dutch Democrats, who knew Kennedy, were constantly with him, knew the civil rights issues, never left the Kennedys, and were just Democrats through and through, and Kennedy knew they were with him. It very much has left a great wealth, a reserve of Democrats. What I have appreciated about that, growing up in that era, is, and around those folks, is they tend to be quite patriotic. They tend, sometimes they're mistaken as Republicans, and yet they are very, very forward-thinking. They're very much Democrats. I just am wondering, were you aware of the food program that Kennedy put together? What they were excited about is he inaugurated a strategic food reserve, and that worked actually until it was sold by later under Reagan, really. And this strategic food program gathered reserves of food, but it was for the purpose of making our nation strong militarily. Now, that reserve is all gone now. It was to store up food here in this country in the event we came under attack or natural disaster. And the purpose of it was to give us a 10-year food supply. And I remember my adult family members saying, what a wise idea.
Okay, let's get a response. Mr. Katzenbach?
Yes, it is. It is an interesting. Is that the one that George McGovern was running?
Yes.
Yeah, it was a very interesting idea. And of course, when people talk about patriotism, it's not a monopoly of Republicans, Democrats, or Independents. It's something that I think we Americans have, and we love this country, and it's, we may disagree as to what is best to be done for it. But that is not a lack of patriotism when you disagree on what is best for the country. But that food program was, and it was a very interesting strategic program, and we were very interested at that time, and I think did a good job of trying to lead the world in terms of searching for peace. But it isn't always easy to achieve.
Mm-hmm. How did you happen to become Attorney General with Johnson? It was sort of interesting that you became, and I know you were in limbo for quite a period of time, because there was, on many occasions, no love lost between Bobby Kennedy and LBJ. You would have thought that perhaps LBJ would have said, sorry, Mr. Katzenbach, I'm going to go ahead with somebody else, right?
Well, I think he wanted to, in a way. Bobby asked me if I wanted to be Attorney General, and I said, sure.
Sure,
well. And he said, well, I'll recommend you to the president. And, you know, you wonder whether that was going to work or not.
Right.
But on the other hand, Johnson needed Kennedy. And in a sense, Kennedy needed Johnson because the Democratic Party needed both of them. So despite their personal animosity, there were times they simply had to work together. And President Johnson did look around for somebody else. His problem on it was he wanted civil rights. He actually liked me fairly well, but he would prefer to have somebody who was close to him, and mm-hmm. that's understandable. But he kept looking for somebody and kept failing. Indeed, many of the people that he asked to do it, like Clark Clifford, for example, were people who said that I should do it. And so eventually I had spent about 4 months as acting. He had treated me as though I was Attorney General. I have no complaints about that. But you can't be acting. You can't appoint people to jobs. You can't make big decisions if somebody else is going to be coming in as Attorney General. And I just wrote him a handwritten letter and said I'd run this as long as I could as acting, and he should appoint an attorney general of his choosing.
Mm-hmm. And then he invited you and your wife for dinner.
And he invited me almost the next day. I was told by Abe Fortas, who was a very close friend of his, that he was absolutely furious at getting the letter. But nonetheless, he appointed me and was gracious in the appointment.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to more phone calls. Thanks, Randy, for your call. We go to Jim next from La Crosse. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Honor to speak with you, sir. This is a little bit off point, but I was curious whether or not around the Justice Department at the time you were there, that there was kind of, were there any kind of winks and giggles about let's just say, some of the peculiarities about J. Edgar Hoover that have been bandied about?
No, I don't think there were any winks and giggles. Everybody took Hoover pretty seriously. The FBI was a very important part of the Justice Department then, as it is now. The trouble was that Hoover had a thing about Martin Luther King. He hated him. He wasn't helpful on civil rights. And he wanted to run his own show, and he didn't really like taking direction from a young attorney general. So it was difficult. Bobby would love to have done more on differently on organized crime, but he did as much as he could. He would have loved to have had a separate commission dealing with organized crime, but he couldn't get that. Couldn't get Hoover's agreement with that. But on the winks and giggles side on that, there was none of that, really. The only incident I can remember that I find particularly amusing was one evening in the Justice Department. Bobby was there with his wife, Ethel, and there's a suggestion box in all the halls there. She put a suggestion in the suggestion box, and Bobby said, "Ethel, what did you put in there?" And she said, "Oh, it was just a suggestion." And he said, "Well, what was it?" And she hesitated. Finally, she said, "Well, I just said I thought the Attorney General should fire J. Edgar Hoover." He said, "You didn't sign it, did you?" She said, "Yes." So we spent the next 30 minutes finding somebody who could open the suggestion box to get the suggestion out of there.
Oh, that's funny. Anything else, Jim?
No, that's all. Thanks very much for taking my call. It's been an honor, sir.
All right.
Thanks. Thanks very much for your call. Our number is 800-486-8655. And what was the deal with J. Edgar Hoover hating Martin Luther King as he did? What was the genesis of that?
Well, I think the problem, basically, was that Hoover was critical of the FBI. Sometimes perhaps fairly, sometimes perhaps unfairly. But Hoover could not stand any criticism of the FBI, and anybody who criticized the FBI, as far as he was concerned, was an enemy. Hmm. And I think that was Hoover did come from the South. He had racial prejudice, but I think it was much more Dr. King's criticism of the Bureau than it was any the racial aspect, although that was present.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about your meetings with Martin Luther King. Center on what you want. I was interested in the part of the book where you're meeting with about voting rights legislation with Martin Luther King and Vice President Hubert Humphrey.
Well, I talked with King many times on the phone, and I talked with him in my office two or three times, as well as the time with the vice president. The problem, we had to get the voting rights legislation through, and of course they wanted a great deal, and we eventually got a great deal. And Hoover and King was responsible for that in many ways. I think that he was very clever in terms, he had a political sense in a way, because he saw Selma, Alabama, as the place to get in which to start his real drive for voter registration and for voters. And that was a very good idea, because it was in Alabama. Governor Wallace had just faded at the door in the University of Alabama. And Selma had a reputation for years back of discriminating badly against blacks. And also, he had the ideal police people there in terms of the people prepared to use cattle prods and hoses and weapons on peaceful, just demonstrating. So he lined up people to vote to register to vote, and they wouldn't allow it. And then he started a march, he said, to the state capitol and tried to go across the Pettus Bridge there, Selma, and they were stopped brutally by Sheriff Clark. And it was, everybody saw this on television. And I think it was, it really was the thing that started the, really got support for voting rights.
Mm-hmm. Let's welcome more phone calls. And our next caller is Ron from Milwaukee. Hi, Ron.
Hi, good morning.
Hi.
You know, many people in the United States do not trust the government or the Justice Department to bring real justice. There's a feeling that there are forces acting, which may have even begun, probably did begin, or at least were very active during the Kennedy administration, and you were in the Justice Department. And what do you think about these forces, you know, that built, or should say, about the American people's perhaps the rightful distrust of what candidates say, what the government says, the single bullet theory of killing Kennedy, and then, you know, all the things that have happened with the war in Iraq and the lies, even Johnson's Gulf of Tonkin resolution. What would you say is really going on behind the scene? Did it begin back in Kennedy, and what's the future?
There's
a
big
question. I don't know what's going on behind the scenes today. I do think what has gone on in the Justice Department, particularly recently, but in other times under Nixon with John Mitchell, was true. I don't trust them entirely, and I think the effort to politicize the Justice Department under Attorney General Gonzales was about as bad a thing as I can have, that I can think of. To me, next to the vote, perhaps, the most important aspect of our democracy is what we loosely call the rule of law. And what it really, all it says is that government officials, whoever they are going to obey the law and obey it honestly and administer it fairly. And that is an absolutely essential part of our democracy. And if you politicize that, if you stretch the law, if you try to shift it, if you don't tell the truth, if you don't have an open administration, it's pretty hard to have a decent democracy in this country. I thought we did that in the Kennedy administration. I think the Tonkin Gulf thing was half a lie, but not. It was not an intentional lie. It's undoubtedly true that he used Tonkin Gulf, and there was an attack. There was an attack that wasn't an attack, and then there was a real attack. But he used it probably to get it against Goldwater. Johnson used it, I think, unfairly to get the Tonkin Gulf resolution, which, as I say in the book, I think was the worst mistake he made. I do think President Johnson had trouble with telling the truth. I think a lot of presidents do. But I think I've never been able to figure it out with LBJ, to tell the truth. I think he himself often thought that he was telling the truth when he wasn't.
He convinced himself.
And I just don't, I never could understand. And of course, it was the thing about Johnson that Bobby Kennedy disliked the most.
Mm-hmm.
I think Bobby Kennedy probably was the most honest man that I've ever met.
What did you think, and I know you were involved in this, the caller asked about the Warren Commission. What did you think of the Warren Commission?
I think the Warren Commission got it right. I think that they were hurt. That one thing that hurt them badly was John Foster Dulles was on the commission and never told anybody on the commission about the attempts on Castro's life.
Hmm.
So that when that came out, it made the commission look silly. I think the single bullet was correct. I know John Connally didn't like the single bullet, but I think that was because Governor Connally didn't want to share a bullet with President Kennedy. I think he wanted his own bullets.
Hmm.
But I think that was correct, and I think it holds up after all these years. It seems to me that if it wasn't correct, we would have had more people, someone, somewhere, would have been telling things out of school, and there would have been attacked. But golly day, they did the best job they could. to try to find out what happened. And if it wasn't right, it was not because of their lack of effort.
We welcome more phone calls in just one moment. We have as our guest this hour Nicholas Katzenbach, who served in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations, and is with us this hour to talk about his book, which is a memoir of those years, and a fascinating one. It really is. Some of it was fun, working with RFK and LBJ. Thanks for your call, Ron. Our phone number, if you'd like to join this conversation, is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you want to send an email, you can do that, and that's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Nicholas Katzenbach is our guest this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655. He was Deputy Attorney General under President Kennedy and then Attorney General and Undersecretary of State for Lyndon Johnson, and also, when he left government, served as Senior Vice President and General Counsel for IBM. Let's go to Beverly next. Hi, Beverly.
Hi.
Hi.
Mr. Katzenbach, I'd like to ask you if you think that we've come very far on the civil rights issue, because I've heard some things, television otherwise, about if Barack Obama becomes president, he better watch his back. I think it's horrible, but is racism alive and well? Just wanted to...
Well, I think there is a lot of racism still in this country. And it's mostly gone underground. Nobody will admit to being a racist, but I think it still exists. And I think any president, of course, always has that problem. It's why he has the Secret Service and the Guards, and I think Mr. Obama has it if he's elected. And I think it is wrong. And I think it is wrong for people who differ with him politically to do anything that would encourage that kind of activity from crazy people. And I think there has been some of that, but I don't think that John McCain feels that way himself. I don't think he likes Obama, but I don't think in his case it's racial prejudice at all, and I don't think he approves of people working up the crowd. He's indicated that he doesn't, but he hasn't been able to stop it.
Mm-hmm. What happened to your idealism during the 1960s, Mr. Katzenbach? You talk about being in Geneva, going to work for government, that great enthusiasm you had. Did you lose any of it during that time? Did you lose the idealism?
I don't think so. I still have it.
I can hear a little bit of it.
I still think this is the most wonderful country in the world, and when it doesn't act like the most wonderful country in the world, I get terribly depressed and distressed, because I think we have we've made a very difficult system of government work. And the thing that I would emphasize is the biggest accomplishment of the Kennedy and Johnson administration was the two Civil Rights Acts, I think.
Mm.
And how did we get those? We got those not because Democrats versus Republicans. We got those because there were Republicans who realized how important this was for the country, and who stood up and were willing to support civil rights and joined with the Democrats. And many of the Democrats, the Southern Democrats, of course, were all opposed to it. So it was a bipartisan thing that happened, and it was great. The House. The bill that eventually got enacted in '64 was largely the work of support of Bill McCulloch from Ohio. I don't think he had a black in his district. But he saw what was happening, and he said it was wrong, and he would support. He's a very conservative man. He would support a reasonable bill, and he did. And that's how he got that. And then Senator Dirksen from Illinois, the land of Lincoln.
Mm-hmm.
And he led the Republicans in his party to support that and to get cloture for that bill for the first time in history. And the point I want to make is that it brought out the best of Americans in politics, in both parties, and there's plenty of good in Republicans and plenty of good in Democrats. And what I want is not people who snipe at each other, but who are trying to look at the country as a whole and do what they think is right, and I think there are still many of them there. Mm-hmm. I do think money's gotten in the way.
Oh, a lot of money. Tell me, there's a dramatic picture. Well, there are a lot of dramatic pictures in the book as well, but this face-off that you had with Governor Wallace at the University of Alabama, a picture of you and the guards and Governor Wallace and the story of Vivian Malone, who's registering as a student at the University of Alabama, another brave person. Tell us this story, because I think it's a great one where Bobby, you're on the phone with Bobby Kennedy, who's asking you, what are you going to say to Wallace? And you got to get those thoughts together, right? What am I going to say to this guy?
Well, I hadn't really, you know, I didn't know what to say to Wallace. It was, I didn't know what was going to happen or what he would say. And I had been up all night for a totally unrelated reason. One of the reporter there had a nervous breakdown.
Oh,
had to
gosh.
Get him to the hospital. And so when I talked to Bobby, it was kind of funny because Bobby just said, the president wants you to make him look foolish. And I said, fine. Have you got any ideas on how to do it? He said, oh, you'll do fine. Which was typical of Bobby. And so I did. He stood me in the sunlight. I had two or three ideas that I was really very pleased with. One of them was that I was not going to take the two students with me to the face Governor Wallace. There's no reason. He was going to say no, and there's no reason why they should be rejected in that way. So I left them in the car and just let him reject me. Also, what was, and I also had gotten from the president of the university, who was all for the integration, the keys to their dormitories. So instead of leaving the campus after he rejected us first time, why, we went to the dormitories, which was at least an indication we darn well intended to stay.
Right.
The other thing that was very moving about that for me was the two people who insisted on accompanying me was the United States Attorney and the Marshal, the United States Marshal in Birmingham. And if you consider what they were doing in that state at that time to their own personal reputations and risk, and I discovered afterwards that the United States Marshal, Peyton Norville, had incurable cancer and was dying.
Oh, my.
And it was just a very... In fact, he resented me. He said it was the Marshal's job. To tell the governor he had to obey the law, but I was very courageous on both their parts, and there were people like that. Macon Weaver was the U.S. attorney.
Thanks for the call. Let's go to Randy from Madison. Hi, Randy.
Good morning. This is a pleasure. I've two brief questions about two different wars, if I may. Your son, John, and your friend David Westheimer, I think, have both written about your experience as a POW in the war. And I was wondering if you could share, by the way, my father, he had very similar experience, and so he was a big fan of yours. And I was wondering if you could share your story about how you were able to keep up with all your legal studies while you were a guest of the German government. That's the first question. And second of all, I vaguely recall that you were you brought one of the first conspiracy or conspiracy type of cases against Vietnam draft protesters, but I don't recall many of the details. Do you know what I'm talking about? And how did you feel about bringing that particular case?
Well, if I take the second question first, one of the reasons I left the Justice Department and went to the State Department and volunteered for it to the president was because I disliked all of the cases that we were getting on the Vietnam thing, and I rather arrogantly, as I look back on it, thought that if I could get civil rights legislation through, I could do something about Vietnam, which I was wrong about and I couldn't. But the conspiracy cases were crazy. And the draft card burning cases and the failure to register cases were These were young people who were idealists, who thought the war was wrong. And whether they were right or wrong about that, they were acting in the best kind of interest, that their love of their country, and they thought something was wrong. And to go back to the other David Westheimer, whom I was quite fond of, and he became a very fine novelist, and I have some of his books on my shelf. He was in prison camp with me for quite a while. I was there for a little over 2 years. And what I did is I had left college to enlist in the Army, and I had 2 years of college to make up, and that's what I spent my time in prison camp trying to do, and I succeeded. When I got my 60-day leave at the end of the war, when I got home from the war in Europe, I was able to take examinations and write a thesis and get my degree at Princeton. I must say that I took a lot of exams, but at that point, I don't think that professors would have flunked me whatever I said on the exam, to be perfectly honest. But it enabled me to go to law school in the fall. So I made up for my 2 years as a prisoner, in fact, more than that.
Thank you, Randy, so much for your call. We go next to Joe from Milwaukee. Hi, Joe.
Hi. I was a white pastor in an African-American congregation in Birmingham in 1963.
Joe Elwanger, this is. Hey, Joe.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I participated with the movement there. And I recall that the agreement finally to stop the demonstrations was rather surprising. And I know there was tension between Shuttlesworth and King. Shuttlesworth wanted to continue because he felt that the agreement that was King was willing to go along with brought about minimal change, and yet somehow it was pulled off. Do you recall, what was there a key dynamic or a key person in there that helped make the difference to bring that to the conclusion?
Yeah, I don't recall the details. That was the agreement that Burke Marshall went down to Birmingham and worked out, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, and he did, I think, a quite good job. And, you know, he got a fair amount, at least by Southern standards, he got a great deal. By Fred Shuttleworth's standards, he didn't get enough, understandably, because they were entitled to more. But I think it was a good arrangement, and I think King was very statesmanlike to have accepted it. I must say, I liked it when the demonstration stopped, because one of my problems I had was Dr. King always had a demonstration on Sundays, which just killed my total weekends.
I bet a lot of weekends were killed, not just because of demonstrations, because of the nature of your job, Mr. Katzenbach, don't you think?
Yes.
Yeah. Anything else, Joe? I know you have a vivid, wonderful history in this time in American history.
Well, bringing it up to the present, one of the realities in our country now that is just is really heavy on my heart, and that I'm working on. I'm on my way up to Wausau to help bring congregations together to work on justice issues. So I haven't given up hope that change.
We have a lot of justice issues to work on. There's no question about it.
Yeah,
we have many people.
Incarceration. The fact that we have more people incarcerated than any country in the world, and working hard at bringing that down. But what do you see as possible solutions here?
Hmm. Well, I think one of the things we have to learn is that the people who are in prison and the people who are out of prison, the difference is often very small. And there's a lot of opportunity for the people in prisons if we have a decent society and if we work at treating them decently. We should think of prison as the last resort, as the last alternative, not the first. And we need better health care in prisons. We need better treatment in prisons. We need more education in prisons where we haven't, and we need many more alternatives in the way of punishment of courts than incarcerating people in prison for long periods of time, particularly for nonviolent crimes. And we need to deal with the people who are mentally disturbed, who are now ending up in prisons, and who are often the really dangerous people.
Hmm. And it brings up a show that we should have on, Joe, and you should be a guest with us. Joe Elwanger calling in. Good to hear from him. Mr. Katzenbach, thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for writing such a readable, absorbing book. It's good. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much.
Nicholas Katzenbach, the book is Some of It Was Fun, Working with RFK and LBJ, just published by Norton Press. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Carmen Jackson for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production. This is the Ideas Network.